started reeling that in, and then a lean cod ate the snapper. So as I was reeling it in, I ended up getting a 2-for-1. As I kept reeling it in, a seal came and bit off the lean cod. So there was like little food chain moment happening just all on the end of my line.
Welcome to the Near and Far Podcast. I'm your host, Zachary Ellis, and this show is about embracing curiosity, leaping outside of your comfort zone, and learning from adventurers like yourselves who have traveled near and far. Today we'll be chatting with Ben Martin about traveling with marching bands and seeing where your passions might take you. Ben's a drumline instructor at Boise State University, and he recently took his students to perform at the NCAA College Football Playoffs. So welcome to the show, Ben.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Zach. I'm really excited to talk about all that.
It's going to be fun.
Of course. Going to start off today's conversation, we have something in common. We've both moved to a new city. What was your experience?
I'm born and raised in Fort Collins, Colorado. So I've lived there all my life, a college town. So, you know, a lot of the folks in my high school ended up going to CSU right there in our backyard. I personally wanted to try something a little different, get out, you know, and explore something new just because I've always lived in the same town. So my mom was gracious enough to take me on a mini road trip to tour a few different colleges. We went through pretty much anywhere in the West that had, you know, the things that I wanted, like fishing and mountains and outdoors, but it still had the music department that I could kind of plug into as well. So we started by going to Montana State, where one of my friends had ended up going. We visited there, loved it. Bozeman's a beautiful area. It was a lot different back then than it is now from what I hear. I haven't been since, but loved that area. And then we kept traversing. We ended up in Idaho. I didn't know much about Idaho itself or Boise. We had a friend who was really interested in the nursing program, and they knew a lot about that. And they also told us about the marching band there. And, you know, again, trying to plug into that music scene, I was really curious about that. So came to visit, kind of a self-guided tour to Boise and Boise State, and checked it out and loved it. Talked to the band director and found out there was scholarship opportunity available for people to join the marching band, which was huge for me. And it ended up working out so that I could come to Boise State for cheaper than I would have gone to the college in my backyard at CSU. So that was amazing. Oh, wow. That kind of sold me on the idea. Not only that, but having the river right there. I happened to be here when they stocked the steelhead in the river too. So that was another kind of perfect timing thing where I was like, man, you can catch steelhead right here in the backyard of your own college. That's amazing. So that really kind of sold me. And so we'd visited it once, and then on a separate road trip, we went on with a couple friends. We just drove through. And so I'd seen it a couple times, but I definitely got a taste of it on my couple of road trips that I came here for.
Right. And I kind of had a similar experience with Boise. It's a beautiful city, such good access to like the outdoors. And like you said, fishing's another one of your passions, and steelhead, I'm a little less of a fishing connoisseur. I'm more of a fish eating person. So
and it tastes good too.
what is a steelhead?
Well, so it's interesting. It's a rainbow trout, so a freshwater species that has actually made its trip to the ocean. So it acts like a salmon in the way that it migrates to the ocean, it lives its life out there, and then it comes back to spawn into freshwater. So it's a unique kind of a species that we didn't get in Colorado because we were so far inland. So to know that they were here in Idaho was really exciting to me because, you know, outside of when I visited Oregon a few times, I didn't know that you could catch them here. So that was really exciting for me.
And it's kind of impressive just how your passions have taken you to different places. You, like, obviously music has given you the chance to have interesting experiences. Fishing has brought you to places where people might not necessarily think fishing is going to bring me there.
Totally, yeah.
Let's take a giant step back. And your experience traveling as a musician started way back in high school, right?
It did, yeah. I was very fortunate for that. So I was in the marching band and the concert band for my high school, Fossil Ridge High School in Fort Collins, if anyone's familiar. So at the time, it was a fairly new school, and our band director was incredible. He was like a Yamaha educator, super great guy. So he did a lot for the program, and he really built us up into kind of a pretty well-known nationally band. So we were really lucky to have that. You know, one of the smaller travel things I got to do with them was go to Indianapolis for the Bands of America festival, which was really great. That was for symphonic bands, so the regular like orchestra type band. That was a really fun experience for me to kind of do that on the non-marching side of band. So yeah,
for those who don't know, that's actually a really big deal. Bands of America.
we were super lucky, and it wasn't the Bands of America like the national competition for marching, but it was the symphonic part of that. So the sitting down band, I like to call it. But yeah, I was very fortunate to do that. That was amazing.
Nice. You also, your high school band took you to Europe, is that right?
Yeah, so that was a different program, and it wasn't the full high school band. So that was through the state of Colorado, and I can't remember the exact name of the program, but it was essentially that each band director got to select a few folks that they thought would work well in this program to give them the opportunity to go on this Europe tour where we would play, you know, these kind of American songs for Europeans over there. We'd play all kinds of different marches and things that were American tunes that, you know, the Europeans over there just love to hear. So,
Copeland or?
Yeah, all kinds of stuff. I mean, like we did the Saints Go Marching and all those like kind of interesting little marches and stuff and just kind of fun tunes that Europeans don't get to hear as often. So that, I was super fortunate to be selected among a few other people at my high school, including my now girlfriend. She was also a percussionist with me, so we were lucky to go on that together. But it was an amazing experience. So we started, it went through seven countries, if I remember right. It was, we started in England, and then we went to France, and then Germany and Austria, Liechtenstein, Switzerland. I can't remember how many did I name there. Was that four or five?
Something like that.
It was all over the place. It was like within 3 weeks. So it was one of those things where you spend a day there, you play your music, and you get a little bit of time to explore, and then you move on to the next country. It was all by bus, but it was incredible. It was super cool. I was very fortunate to be able to do that.
Is that your first time out of the country, Ben?
It was. Yeah, well, outside of Canada, I've been to Canada once on a road trip, but
back to like your first European trip, your first time across the pond. What, as a high schooler, just starting to figure out how the world works and everything, what was the biggest culture shock you had there?
Yeah, that's a great question. When we were there, it was really kind of fast paced because of the amount of time we had and the amount of places we were trying to go. So the culture shock was really just going to like a different country almost every day or every other day. There was just constant culture shock of, wow, I didn't realize that Austria was so different than Germany. And, you know, Americans oftentimes think that they're pretty similar, or even just going from London to Paris and how different that was, even though they were big cities that you've always heard of as a kid, you know, in Europe, they're quite different in their cultures and stuff, and their food and the languages, all that stuff. So I can't really pinpoint exactly the most culture shock I had. It was just the constant change that I was going through there was pretty shocking. So
I'm guessing you had people interpreting for you, or people who knew the languages were organizing the trip.
Yeah, a little bit of that. But I mean, as you might know, English is one of the most widely used, you know, languages in Europe, especially in those kind of touristy areas that we were going to. So it wasn't too much of a problem. Most of the time people could kind of figure out what we were asking, what we were trying to do. So I thought that was very lucky, but it inspired me to maybe, you know, pick up another language one day, because I think it's cool that they can do that. I think we should be able to do the same, especially with how many Spanish speakers we have in this country, and being half Mexican myself, I think that'd be a great thing to do for me one day.
Right. I'm always amazed when, like, I've met children who speak two or three languages, and I think to myself, if they can do that, why can't I? Well, I know their brains are a little more pliable, but...
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I've heard it's easier when you're younger, because I don't know the science of it, but you can pick up on the sounds of different languages faster when you're first learning language compared to when you're an adult and you have to like rewire your brain. So it's a challenge for sure.
So that trip was pretty well planned. But you have a spontaneous side, don't you too?
A little bit. Yeah. And it's kind of forced, weirdly enough. So I'm not normally, I've telling you earlier, I kind of have my dad's engineer brain of I like to overthink things and over-research things. And I've noticed that sometimes that will hold me back from pursuing an idea that I have. So I'm trying to force myself to be more spontaneous. And so far, that's always turned out pretty well for me. I mean, you know, granted, it causes mistakes, but there's that term of fail fast. So I think sometimes just failing fast and learning from my mistakes will get me farther along in life than just trying to play it too safe.
You were telling me the other day of a road trip where you had some of those fail fast experiences.
Yeah, so that's actually a great example. So it was a road trip that I took with my friends as our like senior trip. So after we graduated high school, we wanted to do a big blast hurrah. It was a fishing trip all across the Western U.S. And, you know, we're high school kids. So we have my, you know, old crappy car that can barely run. And we're scrounging up as much money as we can from our minimum wage jobs. So we were trying to, you know, make that work. And we were over-researching as we do, you know, like, okay, here's where we're going to stop. And here's what we're going to spend money on. And here's our budget. And really tried to get it down to a T. And then as soon as we start driving, you know, things start changing. We start realizing like, oh, I'd love to maybe see this instead. Or I know we said we were going to camp here, but I'm really tired. Let's just get a hotel room. Let's get a Motel 6. It became a very spontaneous trip, even though we planned it with an itinerary and everything. And it, in my experience, I think that actually made it a more worthwhile trip because we had a lot more fun kind of just playing it by ear and making things work. And the things that didn't work out, you know, at the time, they weren't the most fun. But looking back, there's some of our fondest memories that we still talk about today.
Yeah, I feel like I try not to just do the touristy things when I go places. Like, if you go to Paris, of course, you should see the Louvre or Eiffel Tower, but there's so much more to places than whatever's on, like, a Lonely Planet book cover.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah, you don't see those things unless you're willing to ditch the itinerary for a little while and just explore.
Yeah, totally. I think you hit the nail on the head there. Like, exploring is kind of the point of traveling. It's fun to see those things that are a bucket list for everyone, but a big part of traveling is really immersing yourself with the culture and the people and trying new things that you wouldn't have normally tried. So totally agree.
What's the best food you've tried while traveling?
There was obviously a lot of great food on that high school trip, but more recently, my sister's been living in Spain for the last 2 years, and I got the opportunity to go visit her. She's in the southern region, Andalusia, so she's near Malaga and Granada, if anyone's familiar with that area. But I got to visit her in that region, and the tapas were amazing. So tapas are like, they're kind of like appetizers. They're these small little portions of food, and when you go there, you go to these restaurants and you order one of these. There's like a whole list of these different types of things, all kinds of things from like croquetas, which are like fried cheese, to shishito peppers, these like fried peppers. And then every one of those, you get a drink with it. And it's just unbelievably cheap compared to what you would pay here in the U.S. for that stuff. So it was really fun to do that, just to try small little tastings of different foods and different drinks. It was amazing. Yeah.
It sounds amazing. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll get into marching band at the college football playoffs.
So many places to go, so many things to see. Wherever you are, make it easy to find more interviews like this one. Near and Far's free monthly newsletter will keep you up to speed about the latest podcast episodes, as well as our hand-picked recommendations. That's only one email per month. To sign up, simply follow the link in the show notes or head over to www.nearandfar.travel/newsletter.
So a few months ago, Ben had the privilege of taking the drumline he leads to perform at the Fiesta Bowl for Boise State. The Fiesta Bowl, of course, is part of the NCAA college football playoffs. I think Boise State was a fourth seed this year. Of course, Ohio State ended up winning the championship, but that must have just been such a cool experience. And it wasn't just the drumline. The entire Keith and Catherine Stein Blue Thunder marching band was there. And your students got to perform on the big stage at a nationally televised game, a New Year's Eve bowl game, one of the most watched football games of the year. What was that like?
I don't even know where to begin. So I guess I'll give you the long story. So like I was saying earlier, I was a member of the band for, you know, my time throughout college. So I've gotten to travel with the band quite a few times for different bowl games and different appearances. Most of the time, when I was in the band, we were going to the Las Vegas Bowl or, you know, the LA Bowl or something similar to that. So this was before they kind of restructured the college football playoffs. So those were great bowl games as well. It was obviously a great time to travel to a place like Las Vegas and play your music there. I was lucky enough to come back this year as the instructor. I've done it once before in 2021, but this year I got to come back and teach kind of last minute notice. If I would have known what kind of season we would have had, I would have said yes even faster, but it was an incredible opportunity. So Boise State was lucky enough to, you know, make it to the college playoffs this year, which in this case, we went to the Fiesta Bowl, which was the second round of the playoffs. So that means we got a bye. So we waited for the next team, either SMU or Penn State, to join us in Arizona. So we got to go there for New Year's Eve, and it was incredible. It was way, you know, being at such a prestigious bowl game, especially one that has a lot of historic context for a school like Boise State, it was cool to be a part of that. It was cool to be a part of that legacy that Boise State's built in its athletics and in its kind of front door and the way that we show up for the grander community. So that was amazing. The organizers were really well put together. We had a lot of help from just the staff and all the folks there that were organizing the Fiesta Bowl. And we were lucky enough to do a lot of different kind of bowl options, they called them. So different events throughout the Scottsdale, Glendale area. One of those things was the parade throughout Phoenix. So we went through kind of downtown. We did a big parade. It was something like 3 miles long or something crazy like that. So that was really fun. We did an event at a zoo. The zoo had some sort of light show going on, so we got to play there. There was a pep rally.
Were the animals okay with that?
Yeah, well, it was funny. When we were warming up, the zoo people came up to us and said, hey, you got to punt your drums this way so you don't scare all the animals. So we definitely had to like do a couple things to make sure we weren't bothering them. But we found they placed us in this area where there weren't too many animals to get bothered by it. But that was super fun.
And then rally. 3 miles with a bass drum. That's like, those things are heavy.
Well, you know, what's even heavier is the drum that I used to play called the quad. So there's six drums. I don't know why they're called quads. Like there used to be four drums, but there's six now, and they're flat. So they stick out in front of you. They're about 50 pounds when you have them pulled up. But when you pull them down, your center of gravity is farther out. So they're more like, if you do the math, they're more like 72, 75 pounds that you're carrying. Wow. It's brutal. And a parade like that absolutely is really tough, especially on those kids. So I'm super proud of them for getting through that because, you know, we don't do a lot of parades like that historically. We do a small tailgate parade just outside of the stadium every home game. But to do a real true parade throughout a city like that, that was a first for us. So that was cool. I'm really proud of them for getting through that.
And you were mentioning, like, you were listing all of the different festivities around a bowl game. For people who haven't gone to one, it's an entirely different atmosphere than your typical college football game. The pomp and circumstance is ramped way up. There are pep rallies and all of the coolest parts of town, and the red carpet is rolled out for both teams and their fan bases.
Totally,
so
yeah.
How do you get an entire marching band to... Glendale is, what, 1,000 miles from Boise?
Yeah.
800?
I can't remember the miles, but it would have been something like a 15-hour bus ride or something crazy like that. We were really fortunate this year to get help because it was such a prestigious bowl game. They actually flew the band on a charter plane, which was incredible. That's only happened once since the bands, you know, existed, I think. So last two times we went to the Fiesta Bowl, they were driven, but we were lucky this time to get that charter plane. So the members got to go on the plane there. And then all the equipment we have, which is the tubas and the drums and all the kind of bigger stuff that even the speakers and stuff for practice, we had to put that on a truck that would get trucked down there. So at like 6 a.m. one day, we loaded up a big truck, send that over to Arizona, and then it met us there. So yeah, there's a lot of logistics when it comes to moving such a big organization like that across the country. But, you know, it's a well-oiled machine by this point. So we've got it down pat now.
And I presume the students had a good time. Was it the times I've traveled with marching bands? I played sousaphone in college. It would always feel more like a business trip than a vacation because you have kind of a rigid itinerary. You have all of those events for fans and donors. Do the students in your band have time to like to enjoy where they are?
Well, you're exactly right. It is a rigorous itinerary, and it was for us too. Every day we were there, we had a pretty full schedule of 12-hour days. And, you know, part of that is just to make, keep us busy in a way. You know, a lot of college kids in a different area, it can pose some issues potentially, but everyone, you know, in the band is great, and they're all well behaved. So we had a great time there. We did have some opportunity to explore a little bit. We had some free time here and there to, you know, explore around the hotel or go to the pool, enjoy that Arizona weather in the middle of January, December. So that was fun.
And the game itself. So you all get to the stadium. What happens next?
Yeah, so we get to the stadium. We're in this kind of warm-up parking lot. So the in-the-lot experience of what a lot of like DCI or kind of the professional marching bands will do.
DCI? So professional marching band is probably a concept that people outside of this world might not be as familiar with.
Totally, yeah, no, that's a good point. So DCI is Drum Corps International. They're essentially like the professional marching bands that they tour, and they play at a very high level. So a college marching band is a little bit different because we don't compete like those world-class groups do, but we do support the football team. But there's still some of that culture that bleeds into a college marching band. So in this case, that was one of those moments where we get to the lot and we set up the drums and we do our warm-up. These warm-ups that we've been practicing all season to kind of show off a little bit, especially because Penn State's band was right there. So we played a little bit for them, but Penn State's band.
Got to show off to Penn State's band.
Totally. They were incredible, though. I want to give them credit. Their drumline was amazing. They were all very friendly. And that's one of the things I love about these organizations, marching bands, is, you know, there's a common saying that no matter what the football team does, marching band always wins. And that was definitely true at the Fiesta Bowl. It was great to meet those folks, and they were very welcoming and very encouraging of us, and we were to them as well. It was great to just have that little bit of community. One of those examples of music is a language that, you know, crosses barriers far and wide. A group that we'd never met before was super friendly. They even gave us a signed drum head similar to one of those, all their members signed, and that was super nice of them. So they were great. We loved them.
Yeah, I remember when we'd meet other marching bands, we'd trade shakos, the little funny hats that band members wear, and there's just such camaraderie. There was a Russian composer, I want to say Shostakovich, he said something along the lines when his music was criticized as sounding too French. He's like, what's a French note? We all play with the same 12 notes.
Yeah, that's totally, yeah, I totally agree. There's actually I did a paper on this a while ago. There was this interesting study someone did. They went to a very remote tribe in Africa, and they're not, exposed to Western music as often, or really any sort of like music from a European or American kind of culture. So this scientist went over there, and they had these pictures of facial expressions. So it was like a sad or a happy or a nervous face, whatever it was. And they would play music that they never heard before. And they'd say, what emotion does this give you? So they play a sad song, and the tribe would point to the sad face or the happy face or whatever it was.
Oh, wow.
And they got it spot on. So that's exactly what you're saying, that, you know, that language really does cross barriers. Even if you've never heard that kind of music before, that emotion that you get from music transcends. So totally agree.
And so you warm up in the parking lot, you exchange drum heads with the other band, the drum lines get to show off a little. Is it anything like that movie Drumline that came out in the early 2000s?
Yeah, no, not so much, a little bit, but that movie's fairly criticized within our world just because it was a little bit, fantasized, the idea, and it was not everything was super accurate in that movie, but I do appreciate the movie kind of showing that world a little bit to people who are unfamiliar with that kind of world. So there were similarities for sure, but it's a little bit different than that when you're in the real world.
How soon before the game do you arrive at the stadium? Because for most people, it's like they tailgate a while, they go in, they watch the game. But for the band, it's an all day affair.
Totally. Yeah, we got there fairly early. So I can't remember when the game started. It was sometime around 7, I think, in Arizona's time. And I think we got there at like 11 or 12. So we got there, we warmed up, we had lunch, and then we went and set up in the stands, and we had a little bit of time to relax. But like you said, it's an all-day thing. We're just warming up and making sure we're prepared, and then do what we always do.
So basically, like, you put in a full work day before the work begins.
Yeah, I mean, even the home games, we show up 4 hours early to each home game. So this season we had a game at 10 a.m., which meant we have to be there at 6 a.m. just to warm up and get ready and stuff. So it's definitely a big lift for any game, but especially a big one like the Fiesta Bowl.
We've spent a little bit of time not talking about the game itself because Ben and I both work for Boise State, and for us, the game was a little more sad than it was for Penn State fans. That being said, the atmosphere must have been incredible at kickoff.
Totally, yeah. I was going to say that as well. Even though, you know, it didn't end the way that everyone wanted it to, the way that the community of Boise showed up, not just the band, but the fans, just, you know, everyone that showed up and supported, we probably, you know, Boise State took up maybe 2/3 of that stadium. There was a good amount of support from our community, and that was really exciting to see. Just to be there was a privilege. So, you know, even though it didn't end the way we wanted it to, it was an amazing opportunity just to be there.
When you're watching TV, you hear different songs, sometimes like band versions of pop songs. Every once in a while, you hear the Carmina Burana. Who chooses all of that? Did the drum majors get a say, or is someone like you behind the scenes just passing the music?
Yeah, that's a good question. So every year there's a show-storming thing we do. This is actually coming up. Actually, it just happened yesterday. Where band members have the opportunity to make a presentation of show ideas and all that stuff. Really, it does ultimately come down to the band director and the assistant director to choose that music and find arrangers to compose that music for us. One of the tunes we did actually was the Yellowstone theme song, which is something that I picked a couple of years ago. So I was very lucky to have a tune that I picked be shown up at the Fiesta Bowl. So that was really exciting.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
And we've kind of come full circle because your journey started driving through Bozeman, and Bozeman's pretty close to where Yellowstone takes place.
Yeah.
It's one of the gateways to Yellowstone, and I had the chance to go there before and after that show came out, and I think a lot of people who lived there before mostly blame that show for driving a lot of people to move to Bozeman, and it's still really cool, but in a different way than it was before. Feels a little more resorty.
I think that's kind of the story of the West in general. I mean, that's happening here in Idaho. It happened in Colorado. All these, you know, beautiful mountain places people want to go live to, and I don't blame them at all. I mean, that's what we all do, try to find somewhere we want to live. So, but you're totally right. It does, you know, the more people you add, the some of that kind of majestic nature that was there starts to get taken away slowly. So it's a double-edged sword for sure.
So in a few moments, let's come back and we can chat about more of this beautiful nature and the fish that Ben found in it.
Whether we've inspired you to add a new place to your bucket list or gave you helpful tips for getting there, leaving your review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify is one of the best ways you can help other listeners find episodes like this one. Thanks in advance, and now back to the show.
Sounds like you've ventured into the rural West to go fishing quite a bit. Everyone who fishes has a story about a fish. What's your fish story?
Oh, that's a good one. The one I always go for was this one time I was on a charter fishing trip on the coast of Oregon. So we went out deep sea fishing for rockfish, which are kind of like sea bass and snapper and lingcod. So these really awesome fish out there. I had one of the smaller ones on, one of the rockfish on, started reeling that in, and then a lingcod, a really big one, actually the biggest one of the trip among all the other fishermen, ate the snapper. So as I was reeling it in, I ended up getting a 2-for-1. As I kept reeling it in, a seal came and bit off the lingcod. So there was like little food chain moment happening just all on the end of my line. That was pretty incredible. Even though I, you know, ended up losing those fish because the seal got them, that was pretty cool to see just like, you know, that circle of life moment happening all so fast right down below me. That was cool.
Like, this was basically immediately the smaller fish or the bigger fish saw the chance and took it, and then the seal, it's like, these fish don't know what they're getting into.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. That's a lucky seal, or I guess it just was at the right place at the right time, two for one. And
yeah.
Did the seal get hooked? Was the seal okay?
No, it was fine. It just got the tail of the bigger fish, so it wasn't too big of a deal. But yeah, that's it's interesting. I wonder if those seals and stuff, they kind of learn that, oh, there's a fishing boat, so these fish are easier targets, and so they hang around and wait for those moments. But yeah, that was cool.
I mean, I had never considered that before, but you know, if I were a seal, that would be that seems like a good strategy to me.
Yeah, that's totally. I was thinking the same thing. It's definitely a, you know, survival of the fittest moment for sure.
Did you at least get the half of the fish that the seal left?
I did. Yep. And I caught a few other lean cod, so I didn't walk away without one of those. Those are super interesting too. When you fillet them, their flesh is actually green, which is kind of off-putting at first if you're not used to that. But it has something to do with the algae around them or what they're eating. But they're just like a cod, so they taste just like any fish and chips kind of cod that you're used to. They just have this kind of green tint to them, but they're super good.
So the algae doesn't make it like pre-seasoned or anything?
Not that I could tell. I mean, we fried it, so I don't think so. But it was very fresh and, you know, not flavorless, but it was a light flavor. It wasn't like a salmon where there's kind of a fishy flavor to it. It was pretty mild.
How often, was that the only time you've gone on a chartered fishing trip, or do you mostly stay inland?
Yeah, you know, being from Colorado, now Idaho, I mostly stay inland. I do have family in Oregon, so we go there once a year, but even there, I tend to stay kind of near the rivers or lakes, or maybe just right off the shore of the ocean, but very rarely get the opportunity to take a boat out there. So that was one of the few times I got to do that, and that was super fun.
What's your usual fishing spot, if you're willing to share? I know a lot of people, they find their spot, and then they need to gatekeep it.
Yeah.
They don't want people crowding their fish.
Yeah, I was telling you this yesterday. Sometimes I like to share because, you know, that's kind of the joy of fishing, is sharing spots and enjoying the activity together. But I totally, you know, there are those few spots that you try to keep secret just so that they don't get overrun or overfished, and some of the good fishing, you know, can stick with me there. But I, you know, within town, we're very lucky to have the Boise River running right through campus and through the city. So I find different spots around town just to kind of scratch the itch. And if I want to go out, you know, somewhere a little bit more remote, I'll try to go just farther in the mountains. And there's a few different rivers in Idaho, like the Salmon River, where I caught my first steelhead. That's up in kind of the Stanley area, the Sawtooth Wilderness. That was a beautiful place. I love going there. In Colorado, we had a similar situation where we had a river running right through town called the Poudre River. So I'd fish there quite a bit, all over town, again, very close to my house. So very lucky there. I used to love going to lakes and doing bass fishing. There was a reservoir that I used to work at called Horsetooth Reservoir over in Fort Collins. I used to be a boat inspector there. So as a boat inspector, I would look for invasive species and decontaminate them if I needed to. But the lucky thing about that job is I got to talk to a lot of fishermen and learn about all their spots and all the tips of the trade they used. So I'd be able to go out after my shift and find those spots and use their little tricks and techniques to get more fish out there. So that was super fun.
Oh, cool. Yeah, that sounds pretty great. Not only do you help protect all of the fishing spots, but yeah, just the, I guess, fishing networking opportunity. I'm probably the only person who's ever called it that.
Well, it's funny you say that, actually. So in high school, we had a YouTube channel for fishing. And so we would post videos of us fishing out there and stuff. And this one time I was working on a boat, this really old guy, he's a very local guy, comes up to me. He's like, hey, I recognize you from somewhere. Did you post a video about fishing here? So there was a little bit of like fishing networking happening there. So that was kind of fun.
Where's one place that you would love to fish that you've never fished before? I also want to acknowledge we took quite the turn from drumming at a playoff game, and now we're just at these peaceful fishing holes.
Yeah, that's a great, you know, there is a dichotomy to that. And I think that's one of the things I'm lucky about with my passions, is music is a very, you know, especially in that marching band world, a very obviously percussive, loud, energizing environment. And there's, you know, there's a great, there's a lot of positives to that energizing, exciting world. But then it's nice for me as an introvert to find kind of that quiet, more introspective moment while fishing. It's a very mindful process of taking it one cast at a time and trying different things, changing different variables of the way you're casting or what kind of lure or fly you're using. So it's a great kind of, you know, to have both worlds for me to experience both sides of that. But anyways, to your first question about places I'd love to go fishing, one of the things I've always wanted to do, but it would be very out of my comfort zone, is fishing somewhere in South America. I went to this amazing conference once where this scientist was talking about the peacock bass there. He was an incredible guy who did a lot of studies on those types of fish over there. And he was explaining how the ecology is so different in South America because of the way that, you know, Pangaea separated. There was something to do with the way that it separated the fish species. All the species down there are vastly different than what we would get here in North America. So it's very different, you know, environment and very unique opportunity to fish down there. Like I said, that would be very out of my comfort zone, though. It'd be quite the adventure for sure. So one day I'll do that.
What is a peacock bass?
It's hard to explain. So like a normal bass.
Learning so much about here, fish today.
Yeah. So a normal bass here, we have like largemouth bass and smallmouth bass and striped bass and white bass. There's all kinds of different ones, but they're these kind of scavenger carnivores. They have pretty large mouths and they're not so predatory like a trout where they have sharp teeth, but they swallow things whole. So that's kind of the general idea of what a bass is. A peacock bass is a very colorful version of that. They get their name, obviously, peacock because of that. They have a little spot on the end of their tail that kind of looks like a peacock feather. They're often very yellow and there's some reds in there and stuff. Definitely take a look at a picture of one sometime because they're beautiful. They look really cool and they can get pretty big too.
Well, cool. I think we're getting close to time. So just going to quickly recap, Ben is somebody who doesn't really get stuck. He follows his passions. He follows them relentlessly. And it sounds like they've taken you, Ben, to some pretty amazing places and some pretty amazing experiences. Any final thoughts or about fishing, marching band, or just travel in general?
Yeah, I think you summarized it well. Like, I would say, you know, definitely pursue your passions. And even if that's not your full-time job or even part-time job, like I'm lucky to say, it's always worth, you know, exploring those opportunities and doing them to the best you can. You never know what kind of opportunities it's going to bring. And if you're a, you know, college student, I would highly encourage you to join your school's marching band. You know, a lot of programs like the Blue Thunder Marching Band, you don't even have to be a music major like myself. I was a business major, but I was able to pursue that. And it was a way for me to keep music in my life when I was busy doing homework and all those other college things. So I'm very appreciative of it. And like you said, it's hard work. It's busy. But sometimes the hard things are the most worth pursuing. So definitely encourage it.
Fantastic. With that, thank you, Ben, for joining us today. And thank you for listening to the Near and Far podcast. If you liked this conversation, don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your fellow explorers. You can find more episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, www.nearandfar.travel, or wherever you enjoy your favorite podcasts. I'm your host, Zachary Ellis. Stay curious, stay adventurous, stay exploring, near and far.